Welcome to Consensus or Controversy, Radiation and Medical Oncology Investigators' Perspectives on the Role of Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors in the Management of Locally Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, a special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 ASTRO meeting in Chicago. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program features the perspectives of four leading clinical investigators: Dr. Shruti Jolly, Billy Liu, Jyothi Patel, and Corey Langer, who served as the moderator. Prior to the meeting, the faculty and a panel of investigators reviewed and provided their responses to a survey with a number of challenging clinical scenarios that were reviewed during the meeting. Dr. Langer began with the first module on the evaluation of checkpoint inhibitors for patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer.
First, we're going to start off with a case. This is a 65-year-old former smoker, stage 3B squamous cell, history of COPD, completes 6 cycles of carbo-pac radiation, but unfortunately develops grade 2 esophagitis with 10-pound weight loss. Durva is planned but not started. The esophagitis ultimately resolves at about 6 weeks. Should Durva be initiated at this point? The majority of you said yes, 3% said no, and a very honest group, 25%, said I don't know. If we look at the faculty, both those here and those who are not here, pretty unanimous. I think all of us would start. Jody, do you think there's any issue in terms of the timing? Is there a point where we should forego checkpoint inhibition in this setting?
So certainly I don't think it's been evaluated prospectively. With the Pacific trial, we know that the window tends to be about 6 weeks. We think about that for adjuvant chemotherapy. For lung cancer, sometimes we'll even go out to 12 weeks. My desire is to get it in a little bit more quickly. I think one of the questions I have or sort of was thinking about as you were talking about the case was, should we start seeing patients every week after the completion of chemoradiation to ensure that we do get the durvalumab in or to assess exactly when toxicity is resolved? So I think that's something that may be practice-changing or clinically important.
Should PD-L1 levels generally be tested in patients with locally advanced non-small cell? About 2/3 of those present said yes, 21% said no, 12% were undecided. And I think we have another question to follow. In general, do you believe Durva should be used as consolidative treatment after chemoradiation for patients even in the absence of PD-L1 expression? Here, bare majority, 54%, 23% said no, and 23% said I don't know. So here's the faculty. Dr. Jolly, you're the outlier on whether we should test PD-L1 levels, at least amongst those here. Drs. Rizvi and Spiegel, both medical oncologists, also felt no. The other three of us, at least those here, felt we should, or at least strongly consider it. Can you elaborate on
that? Sure. So the Pacific trial was independent of PD-L status, showed a benefit. So the standard of care for these patients is chemo-RT followed by Durva, independent of PD-L. And, you know, we can talk about the less than 1% population. And at our institution, we don't routinely check PD-L for stage 3 patients because we're going to treat them with the standard evidence-based way. And the question that always comes up at our tumor boards is that, well, if this patient recurs, we're going to biopsy that area and look at PD-L at that point. So what is the benefit, unless the patient's, of course, on protocol or some other reason that you need that PD-L? I mean, personally, I would like to have it, but it's not...
You don't feel
it's
mandatory.
It's not mandatory. And I was kind of... to create a little bit of controversy here, to have the discussion about this, but we don't routinely get it at our institution.
Dr. Liu, at your institution, Stanford, you routinely obtain it, or at least try
Yeah,
to?
We do. I mean, and I think the point is that we standardly would give the Durva afterwards, sort of regardless, but I think this one scenario where it's helpful is if it happens to be the less than 1%, in somebody who maybe is a little bit tenuous or borderline getting to beat up after chemo radiation, or if they have some risk factors like underlying IPF and so on, you know, we might think twice about it and not do the consolidation in somebody with the less than 1%.
So if it's 1% or higher, you'll embrace it with some degree of enthusiasm. If it's zero, with some degree of ambivalence.
Right.
Is that a fair statement? Of course, the approval in the U.S. is independent of PD-L1 level. And all of us, intriguingly, would give it regardless, all 8 of us. What about folks with EGFR mutations or ALK translocations? Remember, ALK is not really a mutation. Would you consider this? 42% yes for both, 31% said no, and 28%, I love this honest group that keeps saying, I don't know. And sometimes that may be the absolute right answer on certain occasions. So, Jyoti, you're the outlier this time, at least amongst those here. Nair sort of agrees with you, but so does Abby Berman for ALK only. Can you give the rationale and why you might have some hesitancy?
So again, controversially, right, this is a population that was, I think, not adequately tested within Pacific. We have some patients who we know are EGFR positive and ALK positive, but the absolute number is quite small. Extrapolating from what we know in systemic disease, single agent immunotherapy is ineffective as a early line therapy for patients with these mutations. And so I always worry that I may be doing more harm than good. The bigger issue, I think, is one that really concerns toxicity. If we know that sequencing osimertinib, for example, after immunotherapy comes at a high risk of toxicity, often hepatitis and pneumonitis. And so if I'm not convinced I'm helping, I certainly don't want to hurt, again, with an absence of complete information.
So the concern being that if a patient did have disease progression, they had an oncogenic driver, initiating that driver immediately after a checkpoint inhibitor could lead to synergistic toxicity. And
exactly.
We've certainly seen that with durva and osimertinib with fairly high rates of pneumonitis in that setting, higher than you'd expect with either one alone. I'm going to ask Billy this question. We're getting wonderful questions in both from outside and also from the attendees, but this pertains specifically to the timing issue. A patient had a delayed treatment after definitive chemoradiation due to personal family reasons, not toxicity, and couldn't come back to clinic till 7 or 8 weeks later. Would you initiate it? What would be your cut point or time cut at which point you would not initiate? Billy?
Sure. Well, I guess I don't know the answer to that. I think maybe a couple of points, and also referring back to the case that we showed earlier, right? So the 40-day limit on the Pacific trial was from randomization. So that was not exactly like from the last day of chemo radiation. So the time frame is maybe slightly longer than the 6 weeks anyway. But there did seem to be a pretty strong signal for, you know, the importance of starting earlier. So, I think it will depend on the situation, you know, whether at some point, you know, it doesn't make any more sense to give it. But I think, you know, we can give a little bit of flexibility there. But the other point about the toxicity, most patients these days getting treated with chemo radiation should not get esophagitis to the extent of losing 10 pounds and all of that. So I think that focuses a lot on the importance of radiation technique, the use of IMRT, to minimize the toxicities so that the patients can get onto their adjuvant therapy.
So this could have been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Patients with smaller fields, less toxicity, better able to start treatment much sooner, they might do better inherently because they do have smaller volume tumors. So we really don't know the details. Jyoti, the same question. Is there a point at which you just wouldn't bother? Is it 10 weeks, 12 weeks, or also uncertain? You play by
certainly
play by
uncertain, but I would probably go out to 12 weeks for patients. I'd probably give the benefit of the doubt. You know, the risk reduction or hazard ratio is so compelling. I would not want to deprive a patient, if you will, of something that could be so beneficial.
So I'm going to go on to our next module, and this really pertains to the current data that exists for checkpoint inhibition with chemo radiation or after chemo radiation. So we're all over the ballpark here. This is a 70-year-old former smoker about to undergo chemo radiation for stage 3B non-small cell. The patient has asked you to estimate the chances that he or she will experience disease progression within 18 months with no further treatment beyond chemo radiation. So it's sort of the standard paradigm as it existed 2 or 3 years ago. And we run the gamut all the way from 20 to 30% to well over 90%. I think the majority at least are between 50 and 75 or 80%. If we add the numbers up, that's about 63% in that cohort. So if the patient in the previous scenario received consolidation durva, what would you estimate to be the absolute, not relative, but absolute reduction in the risk that he or she will experience disease progression within 18 months compared to chemoradiation alone? And again, the majority are below 30%, about 60% are between 15 and 40. A few of you are incredibly optimistic. 40% are higher, and over 20%, 9% are here to learn. They don't know. And again, Shruti, you mentioned 50%. I don't know if it was a matter of relative versus absolute.
Yeah.
But I think we all agreed that the chance of disease progression within 18 months with chemo radiation alone is north of 50%, at least the four of us in general. So again, this is a deadly illness, and the majority of these folks, unfortunately, will die of distant recurrence. So we have a case, 82-year-old with stage 3B adenocarcinoma of the lung, multiple comorbidities, including SVT, receives in response to 6 cycles of PAC, carbo, and radiation, assume 60 gray for the radiation dose. Should Durva be recommended as consolidated treatment? The vast majority agreed, 73% compared to 11%. This is despite the comorbidity. And in general, should Durva be recommended as consolidation for an older, frail patient who's unable to tolerate chemo and receives only radiation for unresectable stage 3B? And here, there was a bit of hesitancy. 30% said no, 19% were unsure, only 51% said yes. And in general, should Durva be recommended as consolidation treatment for a patient with locally advanced who underwent surgical excision and chemoradiation therapy as initial treatment? And we're all over the ballpark here. 34% said yes, 42%, so a plurality said no, and about a quarter said, I don't know. And Shruti, again, you were the outlier amongst the four of us, not necessarily in the whole group, but amongst the four of us in terms of just radiation alone. Can you extrapolate, please?
Well, it goes back to the such a substantial benefit with Durva, so I feel like they should be evaluated. There may be, you know, many reasons why they didn't tolerate chemotherapy, and perhaps it's not overlapping with the Durva. So I don't think not being able to tolerate chemo is a, you know, complete contraindication to getting Durva, but of course my medical oncology colleagues can tell me more about that.
Okay, so. Jyoti, you're on. Why did you say no, and why did you say I don't know to the second part, the surgical question?
So after RT alone is, I think, a data-free zone right now. Certainly that will change very quickly. So I would probably say if someone was that ill and had multiple comorbidities, that there's still risks with immunotherapy. With surgical resection after chemoradiation, certainly biologically there should be no difference. I think that there's probably a signal there. Trials are ongoing to evaluate this. So I don't know. I think a very compelling patient could probably talk me into it.
Billy, any thoughts on the matter?
You pretty much agreed. I think probably the most correct answer is I don't know for both, right? Because we don't have the data as of today, and that's basically why I said no. I mean, I agree that, you know, there might be some particularly compelling patients who could convince me otherwise.
My big concern, particularly for the radiation-only patients, this is a person who would not have made it onto the trial. They have comorbidities. It's unclear if we're going to realize a benefit in that group, and I really do think we need separate trials. And again, if they're not up to chemo, technically I suppose they could be up to a checkpoint inhibitor, but it's got toxicities as well, and sometimes they can sneak up, including the pneumonitis issue. So major ambivalence, but I veer toward no. And again, surgical question is a separate study as far as I'm concerned. I really think we have to silo each of these questions separately, but the vast majority, as you're all aware, are going to get chemo radiation when they have locally advanced disease. So the data for Pacific really apply to the bulk of patients that we see. So with that, we're going to go to our next module. First, we'll start with a case, an 82-year-old patient with stage 3B adenocarcinoma of the lung, multiple comorbidities, including SVT. This is a real patient, by the way. Consolidative Durva after 6 cycles of carbo-PAC radiation. 6 weeks into treatment, develops mild shortness of breath. Scan of the chest shows no real evidence of active pneumonitis. You certainly see some radiation changes in the retrohyalur region extending to the pleura, but nothing that looks like an active or acute infiltrate. So what should be done? Plurality actually felt hold the Durva and resume when symptoms have improved. Another large proportion of those here would hold it and administer steroids, resume when the symptoms have resolved. Only 19% would continue the Durva and 6% would discontinue it permanently. And here's our answers. Most of us for grade one toxicity of this sort would probably continue it. Both Drs. Liu and Patel specified look for other causes. And certainly in someone with SVT, that would be a concern. Dr. Patel, you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. There are patients with lung cancer who have multiple comorbidities. We often see heart disease, underlying COPD. There are other things. And so you really need to talk to the patient, put on sort of that internist hat, and think about anything that could be happening.
So if you're not comfortable dealing with the COPD, remember the med-onc, before they became medical oncologists, allegedly were internists. So a few of us know how to handle that stuff. And if we don't, we consult our pulmonologist. So a 65-year-old with COPD and other comorbidities, 6 cycles of PAC carbo radiation for 3B, started on consolidated Durva, but after 2 months, presents with fairly profound diarrhea, so fairly abrupt onset. GI specialist sort of washing his hands of the whole thing, doesn't want to do a colonoscopy, is not really much help. So again, a nice response after chemoradiation. In addition to supportive medication, would you initiate corticosteroids? Majority said yes, 57%, 19% would give supportive therapy, and nearly a quarter said, I don't know. All of us here would have initiated corticosteroids, both the panel that's present and the panel that's remote. 63-year-old current heavy smoker with a history of PMR, polymyalgia rheumatica, collagen vascular disease manifested by shoulder discomfort, still on steroids, 10 milligrams daily, presents to the ER with COPD symptoms, and biopsy shows stage 3B adeno. You can see fairly extensive adenopathy here in the mediastinum. Patient receives in response to 6 cycles of PAC carbo RT. Should Durva be initiated? The majority said yes, 56%, 14% said no, 31% again said, I don't know. And here I was the outlier, so I guess I should probably explain. I'm concerned. This is a patient with collagen vascular disease. It's still requiring steroids. This person would have never made it onto the PACIFIC trial based on the underlying diagnosis. And you could probably get by with it, but remember, if you have to escalate steroids, there's some concern that steroids and immunotherapy may work at cross purposes, that we may be ablating the target cells. But Dr. Jolie, you felt to still consider initiating. You want to mention? Why?
I mean, I think that we don't know. Mm-hmm. I think we don't understand the etiology of some of these rheumatologic diseases and in combination with immunotherapy. So, I mean, you know, I think there are certain things that we are very careful with, like interstitial pulmonary fibrosis and, you know, certain scenarios that I would be very cautious, but I don't know if I have that much experience specifically with this, but my bias would still be to initiate Durva.
Strongly considered.
Yeah.
Dr. Patel, same?
I think I would initiate it. I think patients who have stable rheumatologic conditions or autoimmune disorders that have been sort of low grade and chronically controlled on single agent for over years, I have a little bit more comfort with. Certainly, I'll talk to them about the risk of needing to go up on immunosuppressives or the risk of causing a flare. But generally, I think, you know, we say that there is some reassuring retrospective data from a number of institutions that say you, with low grade, you can get away with an ICI. It's different in the metastatic setting.
So the patient in the previous scenario begins consolidated Durva, and 2 months later gets this rather nasty rash on the upper extremities. I might add it was also on the face and torso. It's biopsied, and now it's lupus, not just PMR. Remember, these folks with collagen vascular disease can manifest all sorts of autoimmune phenomena. Should outside of protocol setting, again, we'll get to this question momentarily, but I think it's safe to say all of us would stop it at this point.
I was wrong the first time, I guess. Huh? I was wrong.
Well, I mean, who knows? You never know. But 20-30%, at least in some series, who do have underlying collagen vascular disease may get some exacerbation. So it's unclear that the treatment itself is actually doing it. Another question outside of protocol setting, should Durva generally be offered as consolidated treatment after chemoradiation to a patient with locally advanced non-small cell and Crohn's disease that's well controlled on infliximab? So quarter said yes, 42% said no, and even higher percentage this time said, I don't know. And then similar question in this setting, kidney transplant, majority in this case said no, 56% compared to 12% who said yes. Crohn's disease, I wasn't sure myself. Although I think if they're requiring active treatment, I would probably shy away from it. If it's a history of Crohn's and it's quiescent, they're no longer on treatment. I have personally treated those individuals, something we all agreed regarding previous kidney transplants. I do have one additional question for Billy and Shruti. Can you comment on the dose of radiation in the Pacific trial and how the dose potentially would have impacted the trial results? Or is that still a gray zone that we don't have enough data on?
So we know that the patients were randomized after chemo RT. We don't have a lot of detailed information on the radiation. I think there's a range that we know that most of them were between, I think, 50 to 60 some gray. And not knowing the actual field sizes, the V20 mean lung dose, it's really hard to interpret. You know, how many patients had IMRT, 3D conformal radiation. I think all that detail is important for us to really be able to kind of start analyzing, you know, whatever the pneumonitis risks and other things. So I think it's just that information is not available.
Dr. Liu?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a challenge because the radiation really wasn't part of the trial. And, you know, the challenge is that radiation is a little bit unlike drugs, right? Drugs, if you give a dose, the dose is the dose, right? With radiation, you can say you're given 60 gray, and that can mean spatially an infinite number of combinations of how you can give 60 gray. So I think that is an important factor.
And that poor patient with that awful rash with SLE, assuming we successfully treated it and it went away and the steroids, so we were able to taper the steroids, would you re-challenge this individual? I think we'd all stop it at least initially, but would Jyoti, yes or no?
I would discontinue.
Discontinue?
Well, I guess poking the fire a little bit the first time.
Billy? Discontinue permanently?
Yeah.
Jyoti?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I wouldn't.
Excellent question, and on pneumonitis specifically, how does one distinguish between radiation pneumonitis from checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis? And if it is radiation pneumonitis, can you still treat with a PD-L1 inhibitor, I guess assuming you've quieted down with steroids? So, Jyoti, if you want to address the first part, and then I'll ask Billy to address the second part.
I think it's very difficult to distinguish between radiation pneumonitis and immunotherapy pneumonitis. Clearly, if it's in the treating field, you can say it's more likely to be radiation pneumonitis. I'll call our radiation oncologist and say, do you think this is radiation pneumonitis? But the treatment tends to be the same, right? We use steroids for both of them, and we're not going to give high-dose steroids and immunotherapy concurrently for most people.
Billy, would you have a lower threshold to resume a checkpoint inhibitor in someone who seemed to have just radiation pneumonitis as opposed to more diffuse infiltrate or more fluffy infiltrates, where you'd be equally disinclined to resume no matter how it manifests?
Right. Well, I guess the real answer is I don't know. I mean, it's actually something we don't have data on because patients who had radiation pneumonitis were excluded from the Pacific trial, so we don't have sort of a safety information in that particular setting.
Anything to add, Dr. Jolly?
No. It's just very hard to distinguish.
I don't know is probably a very good answer. The problem is some of these folks do develop pneumonitis later after the checkpoint inhibitor has been initiated, and it becomes a real challenge, and it really becomes a multidisciplinary challenge, I think. Not just rad-onc and med-onc, but pulmonary really needs to get involved if it's grade 3, absolutely. We can't manage these folks alone. So we'll go on to some additional questions. This is our last module. This is a 54-year-old patient presents with adenocarcinoma of the lung, hyaluronopathy, isolated right iliac bone met, so oligomets. That's a term I don't think I even heard about 5 or 6 years ago. And now it's ubiquitous. PD-L1 tumor proportion score, 5%. Treatment strategy is optimal. Chemo radiation followed by consolidative Durvin, 11%. The plurality chose consolidative DIRVA and radiation to the bone lesion. So basically, all hands on deck approach. Quarter said just chemo and checkpoint inhibitor. I guess defer till later to see how the primary disease and the met are behaving. 8% chose PD-L1 inhibitor or PD-1 inhibitor alone. And 17% said, I don't know. Joe, do you want to tackle the fourth answer, PD-L1 antibody alone? This is an audience that's probably not familiar with 042 at least, and that group with only 5%. Would that be an ideal approach?
So patients even with low PD-L1 can have a response, and survival is probably very similar, but for a motivated, healthy patient with small volume of disease, I probably would dissuade them of wanting immunotherapy alone.
And here's how we voted. I actually chose the chemo PD-1 approach. Again, this sort of patient would have fit into the KEYNOTE-189 trial, which compared chemo alone to chemo plus pembro and showed a major improvement in median survival, 22 months versus about 11 months, including the group that had low or no expression. So there seems to be some preserved synergy even in the absence of PD-L1 expression. The other three of you pretty much would do the same, but also consider a local treatment. I would too if the patient's doing well, but I don't know if I'd do it right off the bat. And I'm not sure, Dr. Jolly, that I would actually do a chemoradiation approach. So you chose that basically sort of an amalgamation of a stage 3 approach plus spot welding to the bone lesion. Can you elaborate on that?
And I think if you consider this stage 4, then obviously systemic therapy, and then depending on response, you can do local consolidation. But I think to consider being more aggressive with that bone lesion up front and then doing chemo RT to the chest followed by Durva, I think, is also a reasonable option with a solitary oligometastatic disease. But I think, you know, giving chemo like Dr. Liu suggests and Dr. Patel suggested with, you know, doing chemo plus anti-PD-L1 and then assessing, and then if all that's left is a little bit of lung and bone lesion at that time, I think is fine. But either way, being very aggressive, both systemically and locally, is what I would advise.
I think we're pretty much on the same wavelength across the board, at least in this patient, who's otherwise fit and has a single lesion.
Well, so, I mean, I think one consideration is whether the patient has locally symptomatic disease, in which case, you know, bringing the local therapy up front, as Dr. Jolly suggested, I think is very reasonable. For this particular scenario, there is actually a right answer, not necessarily the right answer based on trial data. So there's two randomized phase 2 trials, right? The Oligomez trial and the Iyengar trial from UT Southwestern that took patients with mostly synchronous oligometastatic disease. So the metastasis is there from the get-go. And their approach was to start with systemic therapy, and if no progression, then do local consolidative therapy.
So coming in with chemoradiation for the primary, potentially, since they're at least stage 2 or 3A, and then SRS to the bone
lesion? Right. Well, on those trials, they would have done just systemic therapy first.
Okay.
And then consolidate afterwards to both the primary and the metastatic site. But I think, as we talked about, there may be reasons to bring the local therapy up front.
So we have an 80-year-old with stage 3B squamous, gets 6 cycles of carboplatin RT, followed by a full year of Durva. So they've been through the PACIFIC trial. Unfortunately, develops disease progression within a month of completing Durva. PD-L1 again is 5%. TMB is 9 mutations per megabase. No evidence of microsatellite instability. And I don't believe any other molecular abnormalities on the report. So what treatment strategy is optimal? Plurality here actually said continue a checkpoint inhibitor with chemo, a quarter or so said chemo alone. 20% would continue just a checkpoint inhibitor alone. Other 9% would be interested in knowing what that is. And 20%, again, the honest folks here said, I have no clue. So, Joe, do you want to comment again on the third one? Somebody just had disease progression immediately after Durva. Do you think there'd be any role for going to another checkpoint inhibitor?
So I would consider it kind of disease progression on Durva at a month later. Clearly, we know that we can give Durva once a month, and it's probably there. So same family, it would probably not go back to. I don't think we have much data that we can enhance activity by going from PD-L1 to PD-1 or vice versa.
So you would definitely go with chemo. Would you consider continuing a checkpoint inhibitor in that setting, or figure that it's probably cross-resistance and just go with chemo alone? Or
honestly, I've done 50-50. So, you know, a year out, like, that's pretty good. They did well on Durva. I might be tempted to do pembrolizumab-based chemotherapy.
I agree with you. I think a minimum of 6 months, a year beyond, then I would consider the triplet. But if they are experiencing disease progression so soon after it, it's a... I would consider perhaps a different IO-IO combination. Mm-hmm. If the patient has low volume tumors, not terribly symptomatic, but I think the standard treatment here at least is chemo at a minimum, plus or minus. And the majority of you, over 50%, said that. With regard to the abscopal effect, Dr. Liu, is the effect higher or better with larger doses per fraction? And does SBRT-like treatments have greater clinical benefit in the setting of immunotherapy as opposed to, say, cytotoxic treatment?
Right. Thoughts? Well, I mean, I think that's a great question that is unanswered at this point because we're seeing data sort of all over the map. But in studies that actually showed what appeared to be some abscopal responses, the Pembro RT trial and the Columbia Formenti trial, both of those, the irradiated lesion was to a sub-ablative dose. And similarly,
so larger doses wouldn't necessarily, it would sort of counter, might have actually counter effect, potentially, or at least more toxicity.
You mean with higher doses?
Yes.
I mean, that would be a concern, right? And so do you need the ablative doses? On the other hand, you know, there's also preclinical data that sort of goes both ways, too. So it still needs to be answered.
Question for you, Dr. Jolly. Patient with a very large tumor, high V20, high V5, really too large to irradiate up front. What would be your preferred approach? Still stage 3B, but would you want chemo immuno alone? And then what would be your criteria for then coming in with chemo reds and potentially durva? Or are you agnostic on how what approach is used as long as the tumor shrinks?
Well, I think, I guess if we have, going back, you know, I mean, we don't routinely do PD-L status on these patients, so we would likely just do chemotherapy and see how the response is. But I guess if you have NGS testing, you may want to, you know, do something more specific to the patient. But yeah, ultimately getting the tumor down enough so we can do radiation and then follow it up with durva.
And presumably some of these patients may have made it onto Pacific since it did allow some induction. It wasn't absolute
right. Occlusion.
Jody, what's your preferred approach when you have a big, bulky tumor and the radiation oncologists are sort of throwing up their hands in horror?
So I think the right answer is probably chemotherapy, but Corey, as you've shown, like adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy improves response rate.
So right? I would probably do both.
So I'd probably do both. And exactly.
And then hopefully with shrinkage, hand it off to the radiation oncologist, continue chemo during it. And frankly, if a PEM-carbo regimen's working, it's non-squamous, I would continue that. If it's squamous, probably a taxane carbo regimen. And yes, that's a situation where I would consider durva afterwards. I think that patient it meets the spirit, if not the actuality of the study. Time for one last question. This is more a generic question. For a patient with 3A squamous, good performance status, good surgical risk, two nodal stations, both found only on EBIS, station 7 and 10R, should we treat with concurrent chemo radiation to 60 gray followed by durva, basically do the standard Pacific approach, or would you preferentially want to give pre-op chemo radiation, maybe to a lower dose of RT, followed by standard lobectomy mediastinal node dissection? In other words, we don't really have a comparison of the trimodal approach versus the Pacific, but what would be your preference? Do you think Pacific is sort of replace surgery in this setting, or is it still an open question? Let's start off with you, Billy.
Yeah, well, it's still an open question. I mean, I think one point to bring out, right, is that, you know, I think in the pre-Pacific era, right, we strongly believe that there are selected patients who would benefit from a trimodality approach, even though arguably the data aren't super, you know, strong. But the key word there is highly selected, right? And so in, you know, a more general stage 3 population, it's certainly not clear that there's an additional benefit to the trimodality approach. Now, the Pacific results change things because we actually see it as, you know, a pretty substantial step up in outcomes. And so is the additional benefit of surgery going to be any bigger than that, even in the patients with smaller volume disease? And I think that's unclear, and then, but the unanswered part of it is, well, then what will IO play in adding on to chemo, radiation, and surgery, you know? So, but as of right now, you know, I think maybe that Pacific has diminished the role of surgery, but that could change next year, right?
GOT, your comments? You're the penultimate comment.
So this is a single station, level 7, and then a 10. So as you know, there is so much institutional bias about patients like that that would be taken for chemotherapy followed by surgery versus chemo radiation followed by surgery versus chemo radiation alone. My preference would probably be chemotherapy, frankly, and then to surgery, and if there was residual N2 disease, then to move forward with port. My last sort of plug for, we have an alliance trial that's actually looking at patients with N2 disease, chemotherapy that's histology specific plus durva, followed by surgery, followed by port, followed by durva. So stay tuned for 2021. Hopefully we'll have data. I mean, a number of investigators are doing these trials.
Shruti, you're the last word.
Yeah, I agree. I think everything has been said already. But there's a lot of new data coming out, and I think this question will get answered
soon. I think the permutations and combinations are ultimately endless. And, you know, in this personalized therapy era, I think we're getting more and more personal and a lot less generic as we go forward.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special edition of Consensus or Controversy in the Management of Locally Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer.